Jackie Brown with your June Club New Life Collective. Can you believe it's already June? Sometimes when we hear people say, can you believe it? Of course we can, because it is. But June is the promise of summer, especially here in Ohio, where we've had a rainy and cold spring. But it's also a time of graduations, of weddings, and maybe the possible getaway for vacation. Also, baseball games. Baseball is a summertime sport that we enjoy from time to time. Whatever you're doing this June, I hope that you are going to enjoy every minute of this month. I also want to thank you for your amazing support that offers so many others a new beginning. And through your generous giving, you are helping people find a new way of life. And we're so grateful. Just recently, I was at our Restore Intensive, and I'm always amazed at how many stories are so similar, yet before they come to an intensive, they suffer in silence. They don't want to tell anybody what they've been through. And when those women come together on a Friday, that first session is a little tense, you know, they're not quite sure. But by the time we go through the first breakout, they are like lifelong friends. It's amazing what new life is brought into their life. And I know it's a play on words, but in some of the situations, they're so hard. They've been struggling for so long. And we're so grateful to see that shining bright light is relit in their growth and then their healing. We're so grateful to be doing that. And you're making a difference. Our Club New Life Collective this month is packed. We're going to start out with Chris Williams, and he's going to share about the consequences of anger. And then next, Dr. Sherry Denham Keffer and Dr. Alice Benton address Rebecca, who struggles with moving out and letting go of a married man. Then Mark Cameron and I will answer Michael's question on the difference between life recovery and AA. Let's listen in.
What's on my mind today is an experience I had this last weekend. I coach youth baseball on both my son's teams. Mm-hmm. And my older son had a game. He's actually out for an injury, but my team just didn't play well. And they were just making uncharacteristic mistakes and just didn't have it together.
Hmm.
And it was incredibly, incredibly frustrating because the things I coach to and the things I coach for just weren't happening, mm-hmm. you know. And it made me so frustrated and so upset, you know. And I got home and I was just like so on edge. And quite honestly,
Mark is here to help you. Now.
Yeah, right.
I can help.
Yeah. I was a jerk, guys. And it's just a reminder. It was a reminder to me that, you know, despite the incredible disappointment or discouragement, there's a lot going on underneath all of that. But it was clear after reflection that human anger does not bring about the righteousness of God, as James says. The other aspect of that is like anger gets this great warning in all of Scripture, and that anger can provide the devil a foothold, mm-hmm. as we see in Ephesians. I love in Proverbs where it says, people with understanding control their anger. A hot temper shows great foolishness. We seem to live in a culture of outrage addiction. Mm. We are addicted to anger, and it's no wonder that we're experiencing so much discontent. And if we look at the course of our own lives and the course of human history, we can see so how much damage anger has done. And so what I want to say is I typically see four things. There's more than this, but let me start here. Oftentimes, anger is referred to as a secondary emotion, and it can be, and oftentimes is. However, it is also a primary emotion. Anger's primary purpose is to key us in to a real or perceived injustice. We see that God gets angry when injustice happens, when people unfairly and unjustly are harmed. But typically in the human experience, I see it's usually due to unresolved pain. If we were people who struggle with anger, we got to look at, do we have things from our past that are continuing to cycle through us? The other thing, number two, I would say is a disappointment with life. we're carrying around this disappointment that won't be shaken. Another sense is part of that is a disappointment with ourselves or an internal sense of shame. And the last thing is unmet needs. You know, this is where we need to seek healing and support and grace and acceptance. Because, friends, anger is toxic, and toxic to us first and the people around it when it's unresolved and misplaced. But, Mark, we see this all the time, right?
We do. We do, yeah. And it can be helpful when we're protecting ourselves and others, but it's harmful when we use it to attack.
That's really good.
Rebecca, who is in Richmond, Virginia, listening on WAVA. Hello, Rebecca. Welcome to New Life Live.
Hi. I'm struggling. I'm in a relationship that is not right because he's legally married, even though we've been living together 2 years. And he's a narcissist. And I'm not calling him names. It's just he has all the textbook qualities of a narcissist, and I've been trying to leave, but he takes everything, and then he's really nice and swoos me back, the whole story, you know, and I want so bad because I have all the faith in the world in God, but I don't act on it to just trust that God's got me, and I'm just struggling to get out of this situation because God has blessed me with peace and happiness before, and I don't believe he wants me to live like this.
Alice?
And I just suggest him.
Your faith is strong, Rebecca, and your desire to get back on track with God's will for your life. So I honor that. And the fact that you're willing to be so honest with us. This must be very difficult to talk about. And I wonder, Rebecca, have you become isolated within this relationship? Do you not have girlfriends with whom you can share what you're going through?
I do, but I can only share with them over the phone.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
I'm just, you know, I can't, I mean, I can go places, but then I'm accused of cheating, and I just don't go anywhere anymore, and I haven't been to church in 4 weeks, and...
Oh. His anger really holds you captive because you do whatever you can to not elicit his accusations. Is that right? You're trying to stay safe and keep the peace?
I just want to make him happy, but I know that the relationship is never going to be blessed because it's not right.
Mm-hmm. Does his anger remind you of anything that you grew up with? Was one of your parents angry in this sort of way?
And it's not the anger, it's the manipulation and the drug use.
Rebecca, can I just ask what your question is specifically? I want to make sure we hit your mark today. What do you want help with? What's your question?
I need suggestions. That's really of... You know, I'm trying to gather tools in my toolbox, basically, if that makes sense.
But suggestions for what? How to get out?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not violent.
No. But let me tell you where I'm getting really curious about you. Where were you abandoned or left or felt to believe that you are worthless, that you don't matter?
It started with my mother and my father.
What happened?
My mom valued men more than their children, and my dad valued drugs more than anything. And there's not even a baby picture of me.
Oh, sweetheart.
Like, and then dad runs off. And mom runs off with men, and I had been in recovery. I've been in recovery, still sober, for almost 4.5 years, 5 years now. I lost count, but I had gained that peace beyond understanding and that happiness. And the day I left to move in with him, it went away.
Yeah, of course it did. You know, it makes me think, the story that makes me think so much about you is the woman at the well with Jesus. Because she had been used by many men. And she had no value. She wouldn't even go get water because of feeling like she was mocked or made fun of. So she didn't go when normal people would go. And her isolation kept her sequestered until Jesus basically told her everything about her and with love and kindness. But the fact that you don't even have a baby picture tells me so much about why you are attached to someone who will love bomb you. Mm-hmm. Someone who is not, he's not faithful to you. He's not faithful to his wife, and he's not faithful to you. He's using both of you. In a way, you've kind of married your mom and your dad. I mean, you're not married. You're living with this narcissistic man who represents your mom, in that he's playing hokey pokey. He's got you on one side, and he's got his wife on the other. That's infidelity. Right? You're participating in that hokey pokey. But it's your mom's history. And then your dad's drug use. He's used drugs too. So do you realize you're living with your mom and dad and you're not being valued? You're not actually getting what you want, which is to be seen, to be heard, to be loved, to be cherished, to be wanted, to be desired, to be exclusive. You're not getting any of that.
And Rebecca, when you've been powerless against other situations, like your previous substance use, you figured the way out. And that was through safe, sober people who had what you needed. You need that again in your life. I think you've lost track of some of the ways you were able to get and maintain your sobriety. And so even though he hasn't been physically violent, I heard you say that there's a lot of violence in the way he treats you. You might consider a domestic violence shelter, which has so many resources for women in similar situations, both the counseling and the employment ways to get back on your feet if you're financially dependent on this man and that draws you back. But Rebecca, you know, you need to get back in with a sisterhood of women, with a group who can help support you and give you the courage and strength you don't have enough of on your own.
And along with that, precious Rebecca, I might suggest you see if you can find either an online or a face-to-face group of women only that have what's called love, sex, and relationship addictions. Because I think what might have happened, girl, when you got sober, and I'm so proud of you that you have 4.5 or 5 years of sobriety. I'm stinking proud of you. But what happened is that addiction got transferred over to a human being.
Michael in Mexico, watching us on YouTube, wanted to know what we think of Alcoholics Anonymous. He started last October. He says life recovery is more meaningful, but he still attends Alcoholics Anonymous. Should he attend both? What do you guys think?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
I think you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I think attend the things that are helpful for you as long as they're not conflicting information. Oftentimes, people need more than one recovery group. And so the more recovery you can get, the quicker you can build momentum on your journey. And so most recovery groups are a 12-step program, and so they have similar steps to them. And I just think that the bigger community that you can build for people who are in a shared experience with you, the more support you have to draw upon when you have times of challenge.
Yeah. And, you know, Life Recovery came from Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. The Oxford group that started Alcoholics Anonymous were biblically based. And then over the years, it grew away from the Christian foundation that it had. The Life Recovery groups uses the 12 steps, integrates scripture. And there's no question about who that higher power is in those groups. And just as Mark said, you know what? A lot of people need different groups. Even if you're in one group, like I know, some of my recovery friends, we talk about different groups that we like to go to for different reasons. There's different personalities, there's different times and schedules, but whatever way you have to work the path of recovery, it is worth taking the steps. So if you have any questions about Life Recovery groups, we've got them all over the world, actually. We have them all over the place, and we'd love to get you connected with Life Recovery group. You just call us or go to newlife.com and we'll get you connected. As our children grow up, some of their actions, or lack thereof, take us by surprise. And that is exactly what Benny was sharing when he called in about his three sons visiting his home. Next, Dr. Sherry Denham Keffer and Dr. Jackie Mack-Harris took a call from Serena about her 23-year-old son's lack of attentiveness to others' needs. And then Jim Burns shared a short teaching on doing life with adult children.
Benny, calling us from Indianapolis. Welcome to New Life Live.
So my question is, I have a couple sons, three sons that I have shared parenting with their mom. We got divorced back in 21, and we've been navigating that ever since. So my boys are here at my place at Thursdays, every Thursday, and then every other weekend. And I kind of feel like they treat my place like the hotel. And I'm trying to figure out how they can take more ownership. What the problem is if, you know, I stay on them about this little stuff, it seems like most of the time that they're here with me, I'm just following after them and correcting them, and we're not spending quality time together. So,
Becky, any thoughts from you?
How old are they, Benny? I'm curious. How old are they? And because you've been divorced 4 years. So what are their ages?
So I got a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 17-year-old. And I would call the 17-year-old the worst out of the bunch.
Well, but you're talking about adolescence, which, I mean, it wouldn't matter if you were divorced or married or whatever. You could be having these same challenges. Mm-hmm. The other part about this, too, Benny, is sometimes in the adolescent years, it feels like they test you as, you know, everything from it doesn't feel like they're grateful for what you've done for them or what you do for them, or that they don't recognize home as, you know, a precious gift to them, as I hear, you know, you're saying. But I'm really kind of curious, what are some of your strategies that you have used? You say that most of your conversations with them are, you know, you're correcting them or saying, hey, you know, pick this up or shut the door or take care of this. Is that kind of the rhythm in your Thursday and every other weekend visits?
No, I've actually probably not been stepping up. I've actually been collecting. My strategy was really collecting a list of all the stuff they're doing and just playing it back to them and saying, look, I was going to call a family meeting, we're going to go through that list and be like, hey guys, this is what I'm dealing with. And, you know, I don't want to be chasing after you for these reasons because, you know, I'd be after you the whole entire time and just kind of seeing if I can get them to come to the table. That was my thought.
Just to reframe, and then I'll let Mark tackle some of this, you know, Benny, them treating your home like a hotel could actually be a benefit. That they feel like it's a home away from home, that they feel like they're being taken care of. Now, I know that that's probably not the way that you are experiencing it, but to provide a safe space for them to be the young men that they're growing into being is very important. And I think at this point in your relationship, you want to look for ways that you can connect with them and not let the house stuff be the lead conversation. And I'm going to turn it to Mark because Mark, I want you to talk about the feeling words and, you know, helping those young men become the men that I know Benny wants them to be.
Yeah.
Well, Benny, this, yeah, three boys, man, 13, 14, and 17, you are in the thick of it. And as Becky said, these are typical problems with kids that age, especially boys, I find. But yeah, so it's a challenging time. And I was going to suggest doing a family meeting. So I'm glad that you've got that in your mind to do. But here's what I want to tell you. Rules without relationship leads to rebellion. So before you do the family meeting, what I want you to do is check in with each of them. Build your connections, because you're saying it's more about correction right now than it is about connection. So I want you to ask them about what their experience is like having to go back and forth between two households. That's difficult for a kid to have two bedrooms, to have two places to keep your homework or keep your things and make sure, like, you know, if I've got something important, I got to take it from mom's house to dad's house and things have got to follow me around. So I want you to ask them, you know, what's difficult for you about living in two different places? What's been challenging for you about the divorce? And I want you just to check in with each of them about that, and just you listen to them, because kids learn through modeling. So when you do the family meeting, you're going to want them to listen to you. So you need to show them how to listen by you modeling that for them. So I want you to check in with them about that too, to find out, you know, what feelings are they managing through this whole thing. Then I think another thing to figure out is, what are things that can be consistent between your house and your ex-wife's house? And if you have a good relationship with her, maybe you can check in with her and find out, what are their chores over there? What are things that are expected at her home? And I mean, you were married for a long time, so you probably have a good idea. And learning to have consistency between both homes, because otherwise, like Becky said, I mean, there is some benefits to, you know, being a home away from a home, but you also want there to be some type of consistency too, so that they know that what we're expecting between mom's house and dad's house is relatively the same, because what you've got right now is a boy's house. And you don't want it to be a frat house type of situation, because you are the dad. But if you can build connection with them, and then you draw them into the family meeting, and I like, you know, the way that you were going to go about it, rather than just kind of tell them off, you were going to, you know, put the problems out there and say, hey, this is what I'm dealing with, and then invite them to be part of the solution. Do you guys think this is fair that I'm doing all of the picking up? And then assign them each roles. And you know, boys this age, it is going to be one of those things where they are going to need accountability, and you'll probably need to do some reminders and keep checking in before they get consistent. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I like the way that sounds. I did do roles in the summer. The time the schedule moves to 1 week on, 1 week off, mm-hmm. and I was giving them roles worked great. It's a little bit harder when it's a short period of time, like every other weekend, mm-hmm. and on Thursdays only. I mean, it's like they're in and out, and it's, you know.
What do you think about the checking in? Like I'm saying, that part's got to happen first, where you check in with each of them, and then you just listen and you see how the whole divorce, shared custody situation impacts them.
Oh, absolutely. I'm definitely going to do that. I like that concept.
Awesome.
I will make sure that I have the same conversation with each one of them. I'll do it separately rather than as a whole.
Yeah. Good job.
Well, and you know what I'm thinking too, Benny, is if Thursdays are I'm assuming during the school year, Thursdays are the deal, right? And do they come in after school on Thursday and then they're gone Friday morning?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so they all three play sports, but okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So here's the other part of this too. I'm glad you said that about the sports. What I would want for you to think about is some sort of tradition for Thursday nights that, you know, it's not home as usual. And if they're playing sports, you can actually build that connection where you're, you know, attending each of their games, or, you know, that they support their brothers. This is really a special time because your 17-year-old is going to be gone soon, I'm sure. But if Thursdays with your three sons could be a special time, and they'll look back at this and they'll remember Thursday was the day that, you know, whether you have the same meal, whether, you know, this is what we do. And I don't know, Benny, if you're into sports at all, but I think this is a good opportunity for you to coach them, kind of like your own team. And I know some of the listeners are like, Becky, he's the dad. Well, you know what? You can speak truth into their lives and you can create a cohesive unit. You know, whatever your last name is, the Smithmen always do this, or the Smithmen are, you know, we value this, and just speak into their lives. Even on just the Thursday, I mean, it can make, you're making an impact in their lives, Benny. And I really don't want it to be just about the chores. Yes, the chores are important, but like Mark said, let's connect.
Yeah, and just one final thought, just to reinforce what Becky said. I think that's genius what Becky is saying about having some tradition, because you know why? That serves as a subconscious mental transition from them, that we're going from mom's house to dad's house. And so if you can do something like that and then reinforce the relationship and the rules, that will really help.
Here is Serena in Savannah, Georgia, who's listening on a podcast. Hi there, Serena. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your main question for us today?
My main question is, how can my husband and I help our adult son become more sensitive to other people's social and emotional needs?
How old is your son?
23.
And has he always been unable to track what's going on in the room or social cues?
He is diagnosed with ADD. So that could play a little bit into it.
It could. Has he ever been diagnosed as being on the spectrum at all?
No.
Okay. So I would say model it. We're going to send you a book called How We Love that will just kind of talk about love styles and attachment styles. I would model empathy with him and verbalize that that's what's happening. If he's not on the spectrum, his ADHD could make him a little aloof. But also, I'm curious as to what we mean when we say empathy. And so the best thing is for him to see that playing out and to have seen that playing out throughout his 23 years, where in empathy is where we join somebody in their experience. We use empathetic imagination to just imagine what it must feel like for that other person. But sometimes we're looking for someone to agree or collude with us, and that isn't empathy. And so I think How We Love can help all of you with how you all attach and how you communicate. And the comfort circle is a great tool for developing empathy in conversation. And so I think using that as a family could be really helpful. And you all practice it. You and your husband, be overt, be very obvious about your empathy, and so that he can see it in action.
Do you know there's a feeling pillow on Amazon, and it's a circle. It's got all these colors on it and all these feelings. And I would encourage you to go buy it and have it on your couch. Is he living with you?
No.
Okay.
Get him a feeling wheel. You can get the pillow cover. It's a little square.
Yeah.
You can get, you can print one out, but you guys need feelings, words around him and around you and your husband.
Yeah. Cause if we don't know feeling words, we're not going to know what we're feeling in order to offer that feeling for somebody else.
Yeah.
We mentioned your book, Doing Life with Your Adult Children. It's available in the newlife.com store, written by Dr. Jim Burns, who's in the studio with Dr. Jill Hubbard and me. And this is a resource that we offer a lot here on this program. I'm looking at the back of the book right now. 9 principles. First of all, I'm seeing a picture of you there, Jim.
Yes.
It's right there.
I don't think that sold anything. It's a best-selling book right now, and I don't think that picture helped at all. I'll just tell you that, right?
Is that why they put it on the back?
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. No, and very small.
Yeah. 9 principles for having the adult-to-adult relationship you've always wanted. And there's a lot of good insight in these books. One of the principles here is, how can I support my grown children when I don't support their values? And that's a question that we're getting so much more nowadays here on New Life Live from people who,
you know, maybe their kids or grandkids or nieces, nephews, whatever, yeah. they're involved in, like, you know, alternative lifestyles right. or whatever the case might be. And how do you do life with adult children who have yeah. maybe strayed from the path? I mean, these are yeah. kids that grew up in Sunday school sure. and everything else, and they're not on the straight and narrow. And
I'm not sure I know one adult or, you know, couple who's married who have adult kids who don't have a worry about violating values, straying from faith, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the problem is we become heartbroken and we become one topic parents. You mentioned strayed from lifestyle. I was talking with a man last night whose two of the five daughters are in an alternative lifestyles. Mm. And he said, I feel like proximity is important and I need to still show love. And I often say, you can't be a one topic parent. He said, my wife's not on that card. She wants to just shun them and not be in a relationship. And, you know, he said, well, what do you say? Well, you know, it's not simple, but I think we have to stay in relationship with them. So I think mm-hmm. we can agree to disagree on a lot of things, but we're surely not going to help them if we don't show them the light, show them love. Because the bottom line with kids who are violating values, they know our values. They grew up in Sunday school. You say sure. that. So, but the bottom line is, I think they're asking, and they don't verbally ask it, but do you still love me? And I really believe that we can move from heartache to hope, but the hope isn't always like we thought. Maybe they're not going to come back to Sunday school, or maybe they're not going to look the same or vote the same way we do, or, you know, whatever. But there is hope that we can build these relationships, but we're not going to build them if we shun them. Mm-hmm. So I think even in the midst of all that, we have to get the help we need. We probably need a course on doing life here at New Life, doing life with your adult children, just to help us, mm-hmm. you know, get strong enough and lay the foundation. Because when your kids are, you know, going into a different direction, we need a sanctuary of support.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us get shamed or we feel guilt, and then we don't go even tell anybody. We want them to act, you know, every Christmas card looks like everybody's all happy. So we want to act like we're happy. We're not happy. Mm-hmm. We need to find people that we can be honest with and talk through that. And really in that support system, sometimes that's what we need to be able to keep on going, but also show tough love. Tough love means that we allow the circumstances of their poor choices to be carried out. So say, for example, they violate values with money or whatever mm-hmm. it might be. I don't think we bail them out. Mm-hmm. I think we allow those circumstances to, well, that's your choice and you're an adult and I'm so sorry. And you can show love, but I'm sorry, we can't bail you out. Even if you had the finances, sometimes the best thing to do is to say, you know what? No, we're not going to be able to bail you out, but gosh, I'm so sorry you're in this situation.
Wow.
I don't think that the kids then go, well, thank you so much. You're helping me. I totally understand that.
No.
I
mean,
they don't come into your office doing that, I'm sure, Jill. But I think it is key that we learn to – we're going to have to be students of their culture and students of how they live and understand that we can still have a relationship with them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that relationship long term may come around. I was talking with a woman yesterday who she came back to church after many, many years. She had walked away and she said she did drugs and men and, you know, all the stuff, booze, you know, whatever. And then she said one day she realized she was really unhappy and lonely and she walked back into church and she just sat down next to her mom and she held her mom's hand.
Mm. Wow.
And I thought, I said, how did your mom feel? And she goes, I've never asked that question, but I did see tears in her eyes.
Oh, of course.
And wow. I just went, that must have been amazing for your mom. She goes, it was amazing for my mom, but it was also amazing for me. Mm. I felt safe.
Yeah. Oh.
Beautiful.
Wow.
It's not always the story. But
no,
it can.
Hardly.
Yeah.
Never. Yeah. But that's wonderful.
Yeah.
How many of us have a closet or two or even a room that seems always out of control or we find ourselves in an anxious situation? Well, Jay called in asking Dr. Jill Hubbard and JJ West why she finds herself hoarding. Then Carolyn received help from Mark Cameron and myself on how to overcome being anxious around a few people. Following, JJ West shares a short talk on focusing on the problem.
Jay, welcome to New Life Live.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, how can we help you today?
Yeah, my wife, we have three living children. She had a miscarriage on the second time she was pregnant on Thanksgiving Day some time ago. Mm. Well, that's traumatic all by itself, but then even more traumatic is that we knew something was going on 2 days before the miscarriage. went to the doctor. He said, everything's okay. Just go home. And she went back to work like the next day, and that's pretty, you know, working and overextending herself kind of made the situation go downhill really quickly when we had a miscarriage on our second child. So the issue is, I didn't know it until like a year after that that she began to hoard, I believe because the way the child was lost is taken from her, so to speak. She began to hold on to a lot of different things. So now our house is packed with a lot of stuff. And I've been trying to get it out. I've been talking to my mom at times. I think I haven't handled it the best way. Like, I've taken things and she wasn't there, or just give her a deadline and try to take it, and just, she just gets really depressed, really sad about it.
Yeah.
And I don't really talk to me, so I don't know what to do.
Jill, didn't you have a recent conversation about this when we were talking about decluttering and everything?
Oh, well, yes, we have talked about that a lot. And so this is, you know, you are kind of already naming it, Jay, that she's had this extreme loss and the behavior started. So hoarding often is around loss. Mm-hmm. And so when we feel completely out of control in a situation, we do what we can to control. So this holding on to things to kind of insulate her and ward off any future loss. And it doesn't always make logical sense because these things are not a baby. A baby is so much more valuable. I think it's interesting, though, that you went on to have two more children after this, correct?
Yes, we did. We did within 11 months of each other.
Okay. Well, and that's rather quick. And so I wonder if you guys did anything to kind of grieve this miscarriage. Mm. A lot of times when it's a miscarriage, people minimize the impact of the loss.
Yeah.
But this really triggered something in your wife and now has been, you know, probably taken on a much greater meaning. I mean, it is a life. It has a great meaning. Mm-hmm. But it's taken on and perhaps representing other losses that she has had in life. And then she had another child quickly two more. So I guess I'm just wondering if she's really had a chance to process it through.
Probably not. Jay, go ahead.
Did you and your wife ever do a funeral, a memorial for the baby that was lost in the miscarriage?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
You did. Okay. And what was that child's name?
It was Josiah.
Josiah.
Okay.
Okay. Mm. Gotcha. And when you were able to do the memorial, the funeral for Josiah, was your wife able to express her sorrow? Was she able to express a farewell, a goodbye to Josiah?
Well, she cried. I gave the short eulogy for the child, and we had balloons. And we released them to the air. I guess that's symbolic of releasing them, too. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm really glad that you guys did that. That's mm-hmm. that is an important step. It sounds though like she is still needing to grieve, needing to express that loss, like Jill was saying. So oftentimes, hoarding is that way. I'm trying to insulate myself from having to feel this pain. I'm trying to insulate myself from having to feel out of control. Mm-hmm. I can't control the fact that somebody this close to me was taken, and I'm trying to, again, it doesn't always make logical sense, but I'm trying to make something that is not controllable within my control. And so it could be helpful for her to write a letter to Josiah, mm-hmm. To express what's in her heart, to express her pain, but also to be able to say goodbye to express what she missed out on in not being able to raise him. That can be helpful for her. Doesn't mean it's going to automatically cure the hoarding. I'm not suggesting that, but it could be a way for her to feel the pain instead of trying to avoid the pain through the hoarding. Mm-hmm. And then on the hoarding side, I would say you gotta lay out, okay, this is what we can and what we can't do in terms of in terms of living together.
I think it might also be good, in addition to just the letter, kind of maybe having some ongoing conversation and maybe like reviewing your wife's life. Historically, what are the other losses she has experienced in life? Because I'm thinking the hoarding is now generalizing, and it is a more in warding off anything bad that could happen, right? And holding on. So I think it's about, you know, it may have been triggered by Josiah, but I think it's become about more than Josiah.
Let us talk to Caroline in Citrus Springs, Florida, listening to us on Sirius XM channel 131. So, Caroline, how can we help you today?
I have a question about if I am in a setting where, like a Bible study, I have no problem with being comfortable and sharing. But when I get in a social situation, like a baby shower, or a luncheon with the Bible study ladies or whatever, I get incredibly anxious. Anxious sometimes to the point of not wanting to go after I've gotten the food ready and gotten everything done. And I just go, nope.
I'm right
there
with you.
How long has this been happening?
I'm the same way.
How long has this been happening, Caroline?
A long time.
Okay, so earlier on, I told another caller that the brain works by association.
Right.
And oftentimes it's in the subconscious here. So there's something to do with that kind of scenario that your brain is flagging a trigger to. A trigger is a reminder of something that happened to us in the past, something that was unpleasant. And so your brain is being reminded of a trigger, and it's starting to shut your body down to resist going and even leaving the house. If you were to think about it here, maybe just for a moment, what do you think that reminder could be of for you in your past history?
I have tried to figure this out, and I like I said, I am not shy typically. I am willing to speak out in Bible studies. I will engage with people. I can do real well on one-on-one or one-on-two. But if it gets to be more than that, I just get anxious.
Have you ever done therapy before, Caroline?
Not in this particular area. I've done quite a bit of therapy for my marriage and for other things, but not in this particular area. And the reason it's come up again is I just went to a potluck with my Bible study ladies, and it's like I sit there and don't even know what to say. I'm just...
You're flooded.
Here's my recommendation is a therapy called Eye Movement Desensitization Reprocessing. EMDR is what it's known for, short. And it's designed for exactly this type of thing, to help you connect what's happening with your mind and your body and your thoughts and your beliefs. And so I would suggest doing that, because there's different techniques in there to help you learn how to remember and learn how to calm your body down and learn how to change your belief for yourself. So if you've done therapy before and you know, maybe it's not really been for this particular thing, I would start there and see what comes out of that, because I think it can be very helpful for you.
Well, and you know, Caroline, the reason why you can't come up with it is for the reason why you need that help. That's what Mark's talking about. Your brain is locked in that this is a reality for you, but it's not. It just is, the brain is telling you, don't talk, don't go there. It's all locked down. So the EMDR will help. I also think that you just described two distinct kind of gatherings. When you're with your Bible study group one-on-one or one-on-two, it's a controlled setting. There's not going to be like this unknown that might occur. Even though it's the same people in a potluck, there's a lot of energy that's going in lots of different directions. And so it can be overwhelming. And that's where your brain gets flooded and you get frozen. And I agree with Mark's suggestion. EMDR therapy would be very helpful to unlock that pattern.
That makes a lot of sense. Because to me, it's weird to be willing to engage
a controlled setting, like discussing a Bible study, and then not be able to engage when it's social. So, yeah, makes a lot of sense.
It is weird, and because you're thinking about it primarily from the logical side of your brain, and but it's an emotional reaction, and those two things are not connected in those moments. So, yeah, what would be a good resource, you think, Becky?
I was thinking about how people grow, just because it goes into just, you know, that developmental and just understanding those different ways that we experience life. And I love, Caroline, that you are willing to do whatever it is that needs to unlock this, because it's great to connect with our Bible study friends and beyond.
A little over a week ago, my wife and I celebrated our 28th anniversary.
Nice.
Anniversary, which we were so excited about. And so, of course, we had to go out for dinner. And also to celebrate, we decided to take on a massive yard project, like people do, you know, to celebrate their anniversaries.
Of course.
This is a project that we'd been putting off for many, many years, mainly because of the cost and the lack of energy or strength to tackle it. It involved replacing a driveway that had gotten completely destroyed by tree roots. It involved doing a new flower bed. It involved moving irrigation lines and heads in order to make room for the new driveway and the new walkway. It involved replacing irrigation heads for the new landscaping beds. And as we got started on the project, things were going well. You know, we were celebrating our anniversary with dinner. We were making some headway on the project. We had some plans. And as I go to get ready to replace some of the irrigation heads for one of the landscaping beds that we were doing, we come to find out that the irrigation line is broken and it's been leaking. And we don't even know for how long. And I thought about the fact that this is so often the way life is and the way marriages are. You start off strong. You've got all this energy. You've got all this enthusiasm. Everything's a go. It's all looking good. And then you hit a wall. You hit a roadblock. You hit some snag, some unforeseen problem. And it's so easy in that moment to lose focus. It's so easy in that moment to get deflated and to want to give up. So how do we keep pressing on? How do we keep moving forward when we've hit one of those walls, one of those roadblocks? How do we not lose hope in the process? And so I think there's a few things that I would recommend. Number one is you have to, in that moment, remind yourself of the goal that you had and why you set up the goal to begin with. What's your why? You have to remind yourself of that, because it's easy to get so focused on the problem that's in front of you and lose sight of why you started this to begin with. So you want to remind yourself of the goal and why you're pursuing it. Second, you want to ask God for strength. You want to ask God for help. You want to ask God for perseverance, because he wants to give us those things. He wants to help us. He's our good Father who wants to give us all good things. And so we want to ask God for help to not lose hope and to keep moving forward. And then I would finally say, well, I'd say two more things. One is surround yourself with people who are going to encourage you. You know, in the project, we've been trying to encourage one another. Hey, this is going to look good. This is going to be okay. We're going to get through this. Yes, we're exhausted. Yes, every inch of our bodies is completely sore. Oh my gosh, I don't think I've been this sore in a long time. But we keep encouraging each other, and the kids kind of chimed in like, yeah, this is looking good. The neighbors have come by. Hey, that looks really good. So that's helped. And then finally, I would say, remember that small, consistent change leads to big goals. And so don't lose hope. Keep moving forward. Trust the process.
Both Chris Williams and Dr. Jill Hubbard addressed our last caller for this month, who struggled with his wife leaving to go find herself and what his response should be. Two teachings will follow. Dr. Sherry Denham Keffer on clear confusion in betrayal, and Mark Cameron on the importance of repair, which is an audio of one of our New Life videos in our New Life video library. There are about 650 videos on all different topics, most of which are between 5 and 10 minutes. You can check them out at newlife.com. And last but certainly not least, our announcer, engineer, producer extraordinaire, Terry McIntosh, will read a portion of a recent letter we recently received. You will want to hear it.
Steve in Washington, D.C., thank you for calling in today. And it looks like you listen to us on Sirius XM Channel 131. Thanks for listening and thanks for calling today.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Yeah. What's going on? How can we help you?
I was married for 37 years. My wife and I are Christians. We raised two daughters. They got married to some really terrific guys. And my wife was a registered nurse. She was struck down with MS. Quite unexpectedly. There was no history, no anything. It flattened her. She had to learn how to walk again and so forth. And of course I was right there. I was as a caregiver and a loving husband and, you know, trying to nurture her through the therapy and all that sort of stuff. When she finally got back on her feet, she went back to her employer and asked if she could get her job back. And they said, no, you're a liability. Well, that shook her world because she had gone to nursing school and had worked really hard to become who she was. And for her to lose everything, it destroyed her. Next thing I knew, one day, there's a note on the table. I've left to go find myself. And it turned out she was going back to her home state where there was a fellow who had asked her to marry him back in high school. And she got excited over the prospect, I guess, of being with this guy. Three separate times she left to be with him. Three separate times she came back. Here's my question. I was really struggling because obviously I don't want to see the demise of the relationship. We had what I thought was a healthy relationship. Mm-hmm. I saw myself as a covenant keeper. I see marriage as a covenant. And so I wasn't ready to throw in the towel and stop contributing to the covenant, if you will. And I remember asking a pastor at random, what do I do about this? And he said, wait a minute. How many times does she have to break the covenant before you realize you're free? Well, boy, I tell you what, free in God's eyes is, I guess, what he was talking about. But I still haven't gotten over this idea of my obligation to covenant. So, folks, where does covenant end?
I think a better question is, where does covenant begin? Because it begins with two people.
I think it begins with the...
But it begins with, I'm saying, with two people.
Yes.
But mm-hmm. Steve, I'm going to be honest. I think covenant is a distraction right now and not a help. Because to your pastor's point, it's like, well, she broke the covenant, you know. But the covenant holds them, like, is sort of like the agreement. Mm-hmm. So, but it's not the marriage itself. No. Marriage is a bazillion other things than just covenant. And so there is something missing in the marriage. I'm not saying that it's your fault, you know, at all. I'm just mm-hmm. saying there by focusing on the covenant, because then you're going to leverage yourself against your wife. Well, I've kept the covenant and you have it. And then you just need to keep the covenant. And I'm telling you, that's not going to work.
But let me just interject, though. When you are the person who has kept your vows, kept your covenant,
yeah,
right? When someone breaks it, you realize how strong of an agreement it actually
is.
Oh,
that's good. Yes.
And
yes.
The devastation yeah. of the brokenness. And so it's it's hard when you're like, oh, my gosh, this is serious.
Yeah.
And I made a vow before God and I kept this covenant. And so it's like, you know, it's like if you're two people holding a wishbone, it's like you're holding half of the wishbone and the other half is gone,
off,
right?
Yeah.
And you're still like holding it, thinking it's together, but you're holding it up something, like you're saying, that's meant for two.
Yes.
And so it's not really what it was intended to be.
Yes. Yeah.
So I need a better analogy than the wishbone, but
I'm going to take the metaphor a step further. You're okay. holding the wishbone, but you got the smaller piece
yes,
of the stick.
Yes, yes. You did.
Yes.
You did. And it's really nothing. It's just a stick. Yeah.
Well, and the wishbone represents the heart.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a broken heart.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm so glad that you said that, Jill, because that's mm-hmm. a very, very, very serious
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't minimize the damage of infidelity.
Yeah.
And the damage that it's caused to you, Steve, and your heart. And so in those things, when we're heartbroken and we can't make sense of it, we're going to try to make sense of it. And the way that mm-hmm. you've made sense of it is the covenant, which is a great way to make sense of it. But she has not honored that. and that she's in this place of vacillating between going to, you know, this is three times back and forth. I'm like, well, unless God has called you like Hosea, you know, to be like, no, you got to stick in it as a representation of me, you know, which, listen, God didn't do that with everyone, but one person he did. But that's got to be crystal clear. The other aspect of it, though, is going to do the work for you, Steve, of like beyond covenant. What does it mean to be married to me? And wife, can you do it? And here's what it's going to look like.
Yeah, because just because she's broken it, right? If she's, you know, humbled and remorseful and wants to work on it, you can choose to stay in it.
Well, and she has to do the actual work of repentance,
yes,
leaving
absolutely
the old relation or this,
yes,
this relationship.
You have to cut that out like
and
a
the
cancer.
Unbelievable hard work of repair.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, this is not a magical number. It's not even a hard and fixed number. But I say this to couples that come into my office that have experienced infidelity. I say, hey, you're going to need to put 7 years in your back pocket right now. Because I'm not saying that 7 years is going to take 7 years or may take longer, sure, I don't know. But that's kind of the standard that if you don't have that in you, then don't start right now. Make a different decision.
Thank you, folks.
Yeah.
7 years is a really long time when you think about it.
It is, but we
at least five.
Yeah, we have to respect how long these triggers last infidelity. Betrayal trauma is so different in the sense that betrayal trauma is a pain and hurt that's happening to you that you don't know is happening to you until it's already done.
Yeah.
And so it flips the internal world upside down. And so it's for the person that needs that healing that I say 7 years before you stop looking back over your shoulder and you feel like you have a really, really firm foundation of restored trust that you can walk on in the relationship where you're not falling through the trap doors of triggers all the time.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I wasn't, when I said the seven years is a long time, I wasn't disputing or anything. I was just
clarifying,
thinking about it, that's going to be, I mean, if you, like you said, if you don't think you can put up or go through this for another 7 years, then look for another option.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that, 7 years, Steve?
I'm still hanging on this idea that the covenant, and I still am hanging on this notion that the covenant is somewhat inconsequential. I just can't get there.
Well, the covenant means something and she's broken it, but you guys need a covenant and you need a lot more than that is what we're saying.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Jill? We have a few seconds.
Well, just that your wife, Steve, would need to really dig in and do some work because obviously the MS as well as the loss of job really sent her into a tailspin.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about something that's happening right now in some folks I'm caring for. And I want to clear up confusion. So I think when somebody is sexually betrayed, what happens is well-meaning people see the reactivity that's going on, right? The anger, the hurt, the pain, the trying to control the uncontrollable, all of those things. And they begin to put labels on the betrayed partner because we're not our best selves when somebody is sexually acting out, lying and hiding things from us. So there's a difference between something that's called betrayal trauma-induced control, which is someone who's been impacted by betrayal trauma that's trying to control their environment. They might try to control their kids, the one who's sexually acting out. And as a difference between codependency. Now, codependency has tails into trauma that can go back into our family of origin. And so it's really caused by neglect, hurt, abuse, lots of things. And codependency in the very core of it is untreated trauma. But when there's a betrayed partner that is trying to control her environment or his environment, if he's been betrayed, that's a natural reaction to post-traumatic stress. That's what's going on. So a lot of times people will say to them, you need to just stay on your side of the street. And you know what? That is really harmful. It is stinking thinking for a betrayed partner, because for them, it's like getting into a car with somebody who's driving crazy and then telling them they're wrong for doing it. We can't let go of our steering wheel. We can't just stay on our side of the street. There's active sexual deception and sexual acting out going on. We have to put our hands on that steering wheel. We have to drive. We have to make choices about what we're going to do. We have to put boundaries down. We have to do a whole lot of things. So I just wanted to kind of clear the air and just give some compassion to those that are sexually betrayed to understand why they look like they look when we're in, you know, different stages of the deception.
Yeah, they're grieving, and people treat it the way they treat people when they're grieving a loss. We don't understand what the other person's going through, and we don't like the way it feels being around them because they're in so much pain. So we try to stop their pain.
That's exactly
by labeling them or telling them, it's fine, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Calm down.
Calm down, mm-hmm. Right? It's like, how can you calm down when the one you love is acting out with pornography, affairs, prostitutes, cyber sex? And that's why we're here, right?
Yeah.
We're here at New Life because we have paths through this. We want to help you, both you and the one that's sexually acting out.
Hi, this is Mark Cameron, licensed marriage and family therapist and co-host on New Life Live. Today, I want to talk about the importance of repair. So the Gottman Institute, which does research and has done research on thousands of couples over the last couple of decades, show that couples who stay in lasting relationships make repairs. Now, here's an important thing to note about these couples, that they do so even when their partner doesn't make a bid for connection. What do I mean by a bid for connection? It means that they do so even when their partner is not moving closer toward them or is still upset at them. Now, how do some of the insecure attachment styles generally handle repair? Well, avoiders usually want to avoid the conflict completely. They just want to make it go away. And so usually repair doesn't happen because they don't really want to talk about it. Pleasers generally like to take more responsibility than they should because they don't like other people to be mad or disappointed in them. And vacillators usually take less responsibility than they should, and they usually like to do nice things rather than apologize because they feel great guilt or shame when it comes to making apologies. Now, let's look at first how not to apologize. So how not to apologize is by saying, I'm sorry, but... that's not a good way to start an apology. Whenever we use a but or a however, usually a criticism, a justification, or an excuse follows, and that usually negates the apology for the other person. Now, here are five elements of a good apology. Number one is admit the infraction. Don't just say, I'm sorry, but be very specific. Say, I am sorry for, and describe what it is that you're sorry for. Then take the time to listen to the other person to see how your hurt has impacted them. In this part, then you want to validate and you want to empathize with the other person's hurt so that they feel like that you have connected with them. That's step three. Step four, if necessary, offer restitution. So for instance, if some kind of physical damage has been caused, if you crash somebody's car, you may have to offer to pay for the repairs. And then number five, making a strong commitment to change, to hold yourself accountable so that in the future, you're going to be less likely to make the same mistake. If you don't have a strong commitment to change, then it's not really a useful apology. Now, what does the Bible say? The Bible says in James 5:16, therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working. Now, I like to say that somebody who doesn't apologize often is either nearing perfection or is not growing at all. So my challenge to you today is, who might you need to apologize to, and to go through the steps of it, of a good apology, and make a sincere and complete apology to them. Well, thanks for listening today, and I will see you next time.
In February of 2024, I called into your show hoping to get direction. I was actively seeing two counselors for well over a year and was actively and aggressively working through my struggles in hope of restoring my marriage of 26 years. I was on antidepressants. I had been separated at that point for over 300 days and had been confined to a shop beside my home. I was participating in what my wife described as boundaries by remaining away from threats or triggers of hers. I was in isolation. I only went to and from work and texted her for hours on end, trying to reassure her. I had ownership for my sin and had done everything I thought was possible to bring restoration to my marriage, and the last thing I wanted was for it to end in divorce. I was in a very, very dark hole at the time. I was really struggling, and I was beginning to think through suicide. When I called in, I was in my own hell. I had already read Sherry's book, but I wasn't prepared for how loving she was towards me. She mentioned her brother who was lost to suicide, and she was brokenhearted towards me, which touched a depth of my soul that I didn't know was there. Thank you, New Life, and especially Sherry Keffer, for your God-created compassion and love you have for those you serve. I hope you all know that this isn't just the knowledge, the learning, the psychology. Those are the small things. It is the supernatural love of God that make you amazing. I hope you all let that soak in. I will not say what I might have done without your encouragement and validation, but I will say I was desperate, and there was little light for me. Again, it was your sincere, genuine, sweet, and godly love for me that I received hope to look towards tomorrow. I, too, know the Holy Spirit's nudge, and that message is directly for you, Sherry. You are a difference maker, and don't you ever stop until He says to. I'm doing very well. I'm continuing to see counselors, and I'm actively pursuing my recovery, and I continue to be accountable in my life. I have met many goals already for repairing some of my broken life. Sadly, divorce is happening. I have learned the Serenity Prayer, and I am making it my life's prayer. I refuse to be defined by my past, nor will I allow shame to rule me. I became a Club New Life member, and I donate monthly, which is not enough.
We always love receiving letters from our listeners and supporters. That letter was another example of just one person's life and the transformation that occurs. You are making a difference in so many lives each and every month. Thank you. So we have some upcoming events. Every Man's Battle is June 6th through 8th in Denver, Colorado, and July 18th through 20th in Dallas, Texas. Intimacy of Marriage is coming July 25th through 27th in Washington, D.C., and we're going to have a special gathering for our Club New Life and our donors in that area, and you'll get more information as we get closer to that date. But if you're interested, give us a call. As your summer begins, my hope is that you'll find people that you might be able to share hope with. Many of you got our little sheep postcard that says, Jesus leaving 99 to find one seems crazy until you are that one. You never know who needs a new life. And it can be as simple as saying, hey, here's a podcast that I just listened to, or I listened to this show at, 1 o'clock Eastern on whatever channel you listen to. You just never know what a difference it could make in their life. Now, I want to share something. What we have done in the last couple of years is when we have a meeting at work, sometimes we get real serious. And so we always like to end on a good note, and we will take turns. Somebody will tell a real simple, corny joke at the end of a meeting. Now, you can imagine some of the things that we come up with. So I thought maybe you all would like a corny joke at the end of this gathering. I mentioned earlier how baseball is the sport of the summer. So here's something for you to think about. I couldn't figure out why the baseball kept getting larger. Then it hit me. You'll get it later. Thanks for listening, and thanks for all you do to make a difference in the lives of so many people.